I love when my children call me just to talk. I love when they text me for no reason. I love that our smartphones make us immediately available to one another. I can't tell you how many times our oldest daughter, now a mother herself, sends me pictures of various bumps, bruises, or rashes and says, "What do you think this is?" I can't tell you how many times I have been both thankful for and tortured by the availability of similar pictures on Google. Google has given me the ability to diagnose from afar everything from hoof and mouth disease to impetigo. I know y'all have the same experience. You might not be diagnosing your grandchildren, you might be diagnosing your own children, your partners, yourself. There is a plethora of photographic medical help out there. If you look like me, or if you look like my brown, though very light-skinned Mexican-American grandchildren. Listen to this story from Usha Lee McFarling. She's a national science correspondent for STAT, which is a division of the Boston Globe. When dermatologist Jenna Lester learned that rashes on skin and toes were a symptom of COVID-19, she started searching the medical literature for images of what the rashes looked like on black skin so she'd recognize it in her black patients. She couldn't find a single picture. "I was frustrated," she said, "because we know COVID-19 is disproportionately impacting communities of color. I felt like I was seeing a disparity being built right before my eyes." The dearth of images in the COVID-19 literature is just the newest example of a glaring lack of representation of black and brown skin that continues to persist in dermatology research journals and textbooks. The issue is coming under closer scrutiny now as dermatologists, like many physicians, grapple more openly with systemic racism and the health disparities it is causing in their field. Now, you might think this is an interesting approach for me to take when talking about the image of God and obviously addressing the sin of racism. For those of you who have been reading the book with us, you know that we're addressing the sin of racism. Refusing to acknowledge the image of God in people who don't look like me. And that is a particular sin of white people, though not exclusively of white people. You might say to me today, with all the examples of institutional racism and all the overt racism and all the hate crimes so plentiful in the news, that I'm taking an approach that amounts to being tossed a softball by a sympathetic interviewer. Well, I've done it on purpose. Because as I talk about the sin of racism today, I do not want a single one of you to leave this worship space feeling ashamed or guilty or hopeless. Especially, I do not want those of you who are white-skinned to leave feeling ashamed or guilty or hopeless. Because to a great extent, we are going to be the change that the world and our country needs. I chose pictures of skin in dermatological journals because there is not anyone sitting in here that I know of who is responsible for that oversight. There is not anyone I know of who has suddenly been overcome with guilt sitting here this morning because you had the chance to include pictures of black skin in dermatological journals and you chose not to do it. Now, you are not going to hear me give a free pass to everyone when it comes to racism, white supremacy, structural racism, microaggressions, any of it, because there is no such thing as a free pass. We are either contributing to the social fabric or we are tearing it. We are not simply standing idly by, perhaps even averting our gaze, so that one day we can claim plausible deniability. We are in it. We're all in it. If we are wearing skin, no matter what the color, we are in it. We are deciding if we will contribute to the social fabric or we will tear it apart. And we will not be motivated in any good direction by guilt or shame or accusations. So listen to me today, knowing that you are not responsible for the sin of racism, but you are invited to share responsibility for abolishing it. You are invited to reclamation, reconciliation, and redemption. Our current worship series is based on the book Christ in Crisis by Jim Wallis, and the book's organized around various questions facing the world currently. And Jim Wallis talks specifically about what our responses might be, and this is one of my favorite parts in the book. He says, what we need to do in moments like this is not to bring our politics into the churches, but to bring our theology into our churches and into our politics, especially in regard to theological issues such as racism. Today we take up the question of what is the image of God? And Wallace outlines three areas in which we are not living as though all humans are created in the image of God. He points out three sins: racism, misogyny, and homophobia, transphobia. He begins with racism, and here's a dramatic statistic. In the next few decades, a fundamental demographic change will occur in the United States. By the year 2045, the majority of U.S. citizens will be descended from African, Asian, and Latin American ancestors. That's according to the U.S. Census Bureau. For the first time in its history, America will no longer be a white majority nation. Rather, we will have become a majority of minorities with no one race in the majority. Now, I think it would be naive and disingenuous to act like these statistics don't give us pause. It's a shift in our nation's order, not in the world order, but in our nation's order. I can't wonder if a considerable amount of the fear that rises in people when they hear statistics like this is the same kind of fear that our parents used to evoke when we picked on our little brothers. He'll be bigger than you one day. Thank God our little brothers did not grow up vengeful. Though he is much, they are much bigger than we are. But here's something that can't be ignored when we talk about this demographic change. This is part of the sadness of the systems we've created. Wallace says, this change in demographics could have us make the assumptions of white preference and privilege increasingly less assumed. But demographic shifts don't automatically translate into shifts in wealth, power, or governance. And the white, quote, minority will still retain economic and political dominance for a long time to come, because of the systems of inequity we have built. Nonetheless, Wallace says, the demographic shift in America with a majority of its citizens being people of color is both significant and dramatic for the culture, ethos, and politics of a new America. And the truth needs to be told that many, if not most, white Americans are simply not ready for that demographic change, especially older white Americans, which was made dramatically clear by the 2016 election. Now, once again, I'm not going to try to convince any of you, I'm not going to spend time trying to convince any of you that persistent, systemic, state-sanctioned racism exists. And I will not try to convince you that we are all racist. I am not a racist. I am conditioned, though, every waking moment. And I must admit to that. I must admit that it never occurred to me that medical journals are written and illustrated for people that look like me. I'm conditioned. I was raised and taught and conditioned to see my white European ancestors as the heroes of the pilgrim story. I am now appalled to understand that the opposite is true. I am appalled, but not ashamed. Shame leads to paralysis and worse. I am open. I'm listening. I'm trying to learn. I'm asking questions. Jim Wallace says the big question has become, who will help navigate this fundamental demographic change? Who will provide the moral compass for such a transformation? We will. Now, perhaps some of you are thinking that I should have had a black preacher or a brown preacher today. But I'm not sure if everyone would have listened to them in the same way, because there's always that little sneaking suspicion of self-interest. Isn't that what many of the accusations are right now that are flying around about the Justice Department and various politicians? Self-interest, self-interest. Preservation of power, corruption of processes. I have always told straight people in the church, I need you speaking for me. Because the minute I open my mouth as a gay person, they think I am self-interested. They don't want to hear my theology. They don't want to hear me saying that I'm made in the image of God. They want to hear you saying that I am made in the image of God. Or maybe they don't want to hear you say it, which is exactly why you need to. Wallace spends time on misogyny and homophobia as well. I want to get to the scripture to ground us in this portion. From the book of Genesis, from the first chapter, then God said, let us, and there's a whole sermon there, let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the wild animals of the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created humankind in God's own image. In the image of God were they created. I wish I had time to go deeper into this. Wallace is always saying, don't go left, don't go right, go deeper. And I think he's right, but I don't have that time today. So let me say a few things about what Wallace says about LGBTQ persons. He says unequivocally, LGBTQ persons are beloved of God, and as all human beings are made in the image of God. And then he says, and trust me, this matters to me. The whole rest of the book I see through these words right here. Therefore, I believe that faithfulness to Jesus in respecting the image of God in all of God's children means affirming and protecting the dignity and civil rights of LGBTQ people in U.S. society and around the world. And then one more. I support the welcome, inclusion, and full participation of LGBTQ people in the church. Unequivocal. I believe he backtracks a little bit in the following pages, but I'm going to give him this. He said it. And don't you know this book was pulled from the shelves of some bookstores and some churches? So I'm going to give him that. And then he talks about not seeing the image of God in women. And he says, many male commentators say they are coming forward to speak out because, quote, I have daughters. And they point to their daughters, their wives, their sisters, and other women in their lives whose assault or abuse would directly affect them. He points out that these men want the women in their lives to feel safe. But then he goes on to say, but I am also committed to changing the horrible realities that exist in our culture. I'm committed to changing the toxic masculinity that infuses our culture. And he talks about how things so seemingly innocuous as locker room talk lead to attitudes, lead to actions like assault. He addresses these three things: racism, misogyny, homophobia, transphobia. And then he calls us to 5 points. 5 ways for us to be engaged in changing the world order. Number one, he says we have to talk about these things in the pulpit. Now, you might think that means me. Well, what good would it do him to address one very small percentage of all of us in churches? I think he's calling to all of us. So from our places in the pulpit and our places in the pew, we have got to name these things as sin, as failing. Racism, misogyny, homophobia, transphobia. I know it's not simple to talk about those things from a faith perspective. It's going to take a lot of practice and a lot of encouragement and a lot of holding each other up. But we need to talk about our thoughts on these issues from our place of faith. Yes, I believe everyone is made in the image of God, and that means me, however I am, and that means LGBTQ, that means trans, that means everything. We have to speak up. Number two, he says, is it takes penitence. The word repent doesn't just mean to say, I'm sorry, to apologize. It means to turn away from, to actively turn away from. We need to actively turn away from white supremacy and white centeredness, misogyny, and take action against it. Number three, this might be the toughest one facing the church. And again, this isn't just about me. This is about all of us. Pastoral care. He says all white people need pastoral care for being morally compromised, contaminated, and diseased by the sins of white supremacy because it has infected our hearts and our minds and our churches and our systems and our structures. And so when we start facing these things and we feel that shame coming on, or we feel that embarrassment coming on, or we feel that hopelessness coming on because this is hundreds of years in the making, we need somebody to say, just do the best you can. Take one more step. See the image of God in all your neighbors. Number four, prophecy. We need to be brave enough to say that white supremacy is an idol. It takes our attention off of God. Wallace says that a big problem with the white Christian nationalist is that all the emphasis is on white. We need to be able to speak about that with courage. And finally, policy. If religious changes in the faith community don't result in policy changes for racial, gender, and economic justice that uplift the common good, then we have failed in our obligations to society, he says. I take this very seriously, that we need to be the ones who encourage each other and lift each other up, who can say, I know you're doing the best that you can, and I'm going to love you through it, and I hope you love me through my doing the best I can. But we don't often do that. Rather, we find somebody who's really trying hard to make changes, and they're like 97.5% changed, and we got to jump on that 2.5%. I saw this, and I'm thinking, this is simple, and this is so true. Me, I prefer mangoes to oranges. Random person. So basically what you're saying is you hate oranges? You also failed to mention pineapples, bananas, and grapefruits. You can't read what goes off the rest there, but it says, I can't breathe. I'm literally not breathing. Educate yourself. You've seen those comments, haven't you? You felt them directed at you when you're doing the best you can. And doesn't it make you feel like, why bother? That's when we've got to lift each other up pastorally, faithfully. I'm going to bring this to an end. And I've been talking about seeing the image of God, and I've kind of gotten close to, when you see people who don't see the image of God in others, you got to figure out how to love them too. You got to figure out how to see the image of God in the people who don't see the image of God in anyone but themselves. So I'm going to go way back to when I was in high school and we were reading A Tale of Two Cities. And at the end of that book, there's a fight to the death between Miss Pross and Madame Defarge. Madame Defarge, who knits the names of her enemies into her scarves. And Miss Pross, who is a faithful member of the family of the Monets. It's a fight to the death. And Miss Pross ends up killing Madame Defarge. And I'll never forget, my teacher at the time said, that's because love is always stronger than hate. And Miss Pross was fighting for those she loved. So I was thinking about that in the context of this sermon. I said, I'm always looking for those that don't see the image of God in other people. Especially the other people that I see the image of God in. And I realized we will not solve these dilemmas by hating those with whom we disagree. By hating the racist or the misogynist or the homophobic person or the transphobic person. In fact, maybe we've been going about it in the wrong way. Perhaps we should stop searching for the image of God in those with whom we disagree and instead focus on finding the image of God in ourselves. Isn't that sometimes the root of it? We don't truly believe that God has created us in God's own image, that God has printed us and stamped us. If we find the image of God in ourselves through reflection, devotion, introspection, if we find all those places where God has imprinted upon us compassion, generosity, goodness, and love, then we can act from those places. And it really doesn't matter so much what the other person is thinking or feeling or voting or saying or preaching, if I'm acting from the image of God within me, it will all pretty much take care of itself then. Amen.